conducted questioning that sometimes to people in protection to our parents. Then, because I think they are not telling us what is happening. As the implement that as the related tools, we are supposed to look at how can we assess them. Coming to the question, I wanted to check the relationship between the, you know, there is a confusion at the border. It was a sad, and it was a very, now seemingly it's sad. It's us, it's supposed to say who's supposed to mend the border. Or I will say, to ask the question to them, I will say, what is the relationship with the Home Affairs, maybe if you can relate to the relationship, how do you work on it, particularly the border? Then you said there is a law of compliance.
But you didn't tell us by whom. You said there is a law, L-O-W, of compliance. If you can take us through who is not complying with what. Then maybe you can tell us or ask us how can we assist to these problems, because I think we have just mentioned the problems. That's where there are shortcomings, there are challenges here and there. As the members of parliament, if you can say to us, we need parliamentarians to rectify this and that, so that we can be able to assist. And finally, I will say, there was a presentation about the WTO and these agreements to say we were talking about the imports of cars to the country, and we were talking about the automotive sector here to say they are becoming redundant. There was an argument to say when it comes to employment, they were saying the auto sector manufacturers are not employing many people. The people are being employed in service. So it means that even if the car are being imported, you still the service employment will be there. It will not be affected by the closing of the auto sector. I just wanted to say, what is your thinking in that? Is it a sound thinking, or I'll say it is a sound logic to say even if we get import cars, the jobs will still be, services will be as many as we can, even if we are building the cars inside the country. But it's not relevant to what we have presented. I just wanted to find out what is your thinking there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Whip. You heard what members have said, but I just wanted to add also a few issues that I feel will be helpful in clarifying to the members here. You know, when you introduced your strategic mandate and outcomes as SARS, you referred to the fact that you have an electronic release system that is helping you to know what's coming into the country beforehand. And as you continued, you know, you made me worried, because it's like the very same system that you have put in place is not really helping you. Because if that's the case, then you would be knowing exactly who's bringing what and when, and then you'll be able then to respond to the situation at hand. So I think Will I be correct to say the system has its own challenges at the moment? Or am I referring, did I not understand you correctly? You've put an acronym MIDP. I would love to be clear, you know, we are fundis in some of these issues. I thought in terms of your problem definition, you really tried to respond to this problem through slide 18. But we will all agree that that's not sufficient. I think that's why the follow-up question on that. Maybe if you can just explain further as to what you... And then here on the... You're saying the root cause of the problem here is that it's because of our opening of the international trade. I don't know who to blame, Member Nduli here. Who was supposed to advise who in this regard? Because, you see, if this is a serious challenge, is it a real problem or is it because it caught us unprepared? Because really, if there's a decision to open up, surely the role players must be in a position to put up, you know, whatever measures that they have to, so that they are able to respond to the any eventuality. That is how I understand planning. If really we were caught napping, looking at the measures that you've already alluded to, I don't think that we're responding enough. I don't know. That's my perception. You are saying in terms of the root cause, one of the issues is around the corrupt officials, and you said you have exited some of these officials. Can we get an indication of how many of such, if they can be put in a tabular form? Yes, the cause, and so forth, so that we can be able to track whether there is any progress to that regard or not. The gap that you've identified, I think I agree with what you said in terms of designating certain commodities to a particular point of entry. I agree with that. And you see, you put some limitation there when you said the business is not happy with that. Yes, I agree that the matter is before NEDLAC, but is that matter supposed to be there? Is it a matter to be negotiated, or is it a matter of security of the country that doesn't need any negotiation? Who really sets issues that need to go to NEDLAC, or issues that really do not need such engagement? I think there are certain issues we should be able to prioritize in this regard. I want to agree with my colleagues here on the issues of causes related to custom administration and so forth. They are very, very important. And I know that finance has, you know, put in place or has negotiated with certain institutions of higher learning to... in order to be able to offer certain courses that are of necessity to the country, especially those that are scarce in the country. I don't know why did this one skip the department's mind? Because I see ourselves recycling people within, and we might be complaining of fraud and whatever. That these people with 40 years experience within, in the system, they are mastering the system, and you might be complaining of people coming from where and so forth. These people master the system. They are the ones who are putting up the system. They master the system, and they do whatever they want. And it's very, very difficult. From my experience in government, it's very, very difficult to track and to catch such people. The ones that you catch are those that are new entries, that are amateurs. But the main people who have more experience within the system, you won't be able to catch them because they know the ins and outs of this, and they know how to maneuver within the system. So I think the sooner we look into the unemployed youth, and then we implement what my colleague Mabas was talking about in terms of what were you referring to? I think we have learnerships and internship program. I think that would assist in the interim while we're still looking at the relationship with institutions of higher learning. There's one other issue. You know, from what you have in terms of your slide, what slide is that? 11. Am I correct? Yeah. You highlighted main ports of entry here. And I'm wondering whether, in terms of surveillance, this might be main ports of entry, but then it means that your focus is on this particular port of entry, and therefore the rest, there'll be less focus. If my assumption is correct, then I think we really need to relook at this, because we might be, it is possible that we are really not doing much in terms of the real surveillance. If you look at the traffic between Mozambique and South Africa, the traffic between Swaziland and South Africa, and Swaziland alone has so many of them. Mozambique, well, we can talk of one, which is Maine. I'm not sure whether that is not of a concern to you, but I would prefer that, because I'm from that area, then I understand them better. It is important that perhaps you relook at it, at what you classify as Maine. Because to me, if it's Maine, it means it gets major focus and attention. Because we might be letting other things go by without proper surveillance. You know, when you responded to, because I'm happy that you put a slide that explains your the data related to disposals. And I'm aware that you are only dealing with clothing, textiles, leather, and footwear. That's your main focus. But I was a bit worried before you came to the slide in terms of, I had a question as to what happens to the goods to the confiscated goods. Why was I concerned? It's because I think we are letting, you know, I don't have facts to support what I'm saying, but from the look of things, I think we are leaving so many things to circulate around. You know, the concern of the business is real, but are they not culprits in this regard? They are, to me, the main culprits. And it's important that you focus there more than ever before. And then who then, is there someone within SARS who is responsible for tracking, you know, registering, continuous monitoring of the goods that are in your warehouse? How many go out? Do we have such a record? If we have, I think it's very, very important that we are supplied with a copy, just a copy of one sample. I know there's a lot. Just a sample of what is really taking place there, so that we can see whether this is really there's a system in place to check these things or not. On the issue of naming and shaming, I heard you saying that you are skeptical of this matter. Are you not protective, too protective, under the disguise of law? Because I think there's a room for that. You may say the law doesn't allow, but there might be other law governing other governing other institutions that can allow you to do that. Can we look at that? Because really, unless we name and shame, we won't be able to really deal with this, the problem of some of the traders that are quite out of place. Can we also get the time frames in terms of your plans? That you are saying you are busy planning in terms of the cross border inspection, inspection of factories. Can we get an indication as to when are you planning to implement or to actualize this particular plan? Just the time frame so that we know exactly, because you know we have these challenges. Time is not waiting for us. Fraudulent activities are taking place. And these people are very good at reading us, and they know exactly where we are, what we are planning, and so forth. If we don't move with them, we might find ourselves really losing the battle before we even start, dealing with it. Okay, the issue of the charitable organizations, I wanted to ask you, indicated that you have a tracking system in place. So I think I'm answered on that. That is the I wanted also to ask you last question. There's under your slide 18, you saying these statistics are from March to date to June 2009. I don't understand what you mean by this. March to date to June 2009. What should we read out of this? Is it the current? Is it to date? When you mean to date, is it as in October? Or should we take to date as June 2009? I think the problem around, you have 883 cases, and then out of that, you could only process 259. That's what you said? And out of 259, only 191 are successful. I'm not sure. That's what I'm reading. But then the 351 comes from the number of cases in terms of auditing. I don't know. Can you clarify that? And the number of successful audits are 98. Which comes first? Is it the auditing? Is it examination? I think, can you clarify on that matter, because I'm not too sure. And how accurate is this scanner, the Devon scanner? Sorry, we might have given you too many questions to handle, but you will appreciate that this is our main focus right now, that of customs fraud, and want to be sure that what you are really doing in responding to this is effective enough. Thank you very much. Platform is yours.
Thank you, Chairman, and honorable members. I will respond to some of these questions, and my colleagues will assist me. The first question by Dr. Rabi around the guesstimation of the revenue loss is difficult for us at this stage, and I'll tell you what we are doing. We commissioned a study to be conducted to look into how much is the value of illicit trade that we deal with in customs. So it could be smuggling of abalone, it could be cigarette smuggling and all that. We are currently working on that study to get the full quantum of the value of illicit trade. And the view was that once we get the full quantum, we break it down. As it is now, we don't have anything reliable that we can rely on, Chairperson and Dr. Rabi. We're working on it. We're trying to understand. That discussion is happening at the same time as determining what is the tax gap. That we're collecting these billions in revenue, but how much is it we're not collecting? So it's a bigger research that we're trying to conduct. And we also feel that how we get measured at the revenue authority should be based on how many extra steps we're taking to get that which we are not getting currently. So it's part of that study that we're conducting. We're trying to benchmark with other authorities that have done it before to get a sense of what is there. So there's a research underway now that is looking into that. There was another question. We could get that to the committee with a written response on that. There was an issue around discrepancies in pricing. You made an example with a leather shoe from India vis-a-vis the hide, the prices. I'm not an expert in that field, but what we have realized is that countries like India, China, Indonesia, and lately Turkey, their clothing items are very cheap, because they operate with a different model. They push productivity at whatever cost. And if they sell volume, they make profit. I think these are different models as compared to South Africa's model. I mean, some of those countries in their manufacturing sector, their human rights records are being questioned for how they treat their employees. Are they casualized labor? Are they full-time employees, and that determines how much are they being paid. It determines the price of the product, because you don't have a huge labor cost. You can sell your product at a very cheap. And I think it's very important to also draw that line between cheap imports and undervalued goods, which are not counterfeit at all. Like, because the production cost is so minimal, these products from these countries will come to South Africa very cheap, because they didn't spend much money in the production there. Like I said, I'm not an expert in that field, but the explanation that some economists will give you is that it's because the production costs are very minimal in those countries. And then which, as compared to us, from a competitiveness point of view, they'll always have an edge over us because of that. The issue around porous borders, Chairperson, and I'll try and respond to this question together with the question raised by Honorable Ntuli on the relationships at the border. Currently, up until now recently, patrolling the borderline has always been the responsibility of the police. And the reason given then was that the National Defense Force It's not a policing unit. They are trained to fight wars, to shoot, and you know. And I didn't want to say that. So. And many of these people crossing the border. Many of these people crossing the border are civilians. Some of them are unaccompanied minors. So it was felt that if you put the army there, they may not have been trained to deal with such situations. And the police were manning the borders. At the port of entry, you had a structure called, actually still there, the Border Control Operational Coordinating Committee, which wasn't meant to run the border, to coordinate activities. If there are joint activities to be coordinated, that structure plays that role. It was with Home Affairs up until January 2007 when it was transferred to SARS. So SARS is not per se running the border. It was about coordinating activities at the border, ensuring that, for instance, a trader doesn't get stopped two times by SARS and then next by the police, because that hampers facilitation of trade. So it was to say every morning we meet from 7 to 7:15, agree on a plan of action for the day, and then we go and work and try and prevent as much as possible the bottleneck that may be created there. So coming back to porosity of our borders, I mean, there's been a problem. I think we know between South Africa and Zimbabwe. It started as people, civilians coming in, but they got later accompanied by armed people who were involved in some form of people trafficking and human smuggling. So the army is going back now to look at the borderline. I'm told they'll be going back very soon. From a port of entry point of view, there are discussions now happening around the creation of a single border management agency. In the medium-term strategy framework as released by the presidency, the statement read, establishment of a border management agency to manage customs and migration, and also effect of customs migration and land borderline control services, and also effectively coordinate work of other departments at the border. So there are discussions going on. We're involved in those discussions. They are being led by the Ministry of State Security. So I think it is envisaged that by next year sometime, before the 2010 FIFA World Cup, there'll be a new entity looking at managing our borders, both the borderline and the ports of entry. So those discussions, like I said, are being led by the Ministry of State Security. Coming to Dr. Huang's question around how many officials have been caught and charged internally for assisting fraudster to commit fraud. There are figures that I've got here that will ensure that they get sent to the Secretariat of the Committee.
Okay, that's what I said you can send in the format that I gave you. Yeah. You don't need to indicate now. Yeah.
Thanks, Chair. Yeah, on the quantities of counterfeit versus value, my colleague Mkwebisi Basi will talk to it later. On the retail prices, what is that retailer currently? The doctor spoke about some of it coming from Indonesia, Bangladesh, and all that. But our test doesn't reflect that as in terms of the number of volumes or the volume coming into the country. The biggest importer is China, and it doesn't necessarily mean that those goods are undervalued. I think this is the point that we're trying to make, that it doesn't mean that all goods from China are undervalued. I think there could be those that are undervalued, and there are also those that are just cheap. I mean, if a suit comes in from any other country at $1, we would know that this is undervalued. But there are some borderline cases where you, when you do your comparative, you find that they are not undervalued, they're just cheap. And maybe the role that China plays in trade today. China is a big player. And I think it's based on the business models in their own country. The U.S. will tell you the very same thing. Australia, Canada, New Zealand, everybody will be telling you that there's a surge in imports from China. And in an open market economy, that's what happens. Where there is demand, the supply will always increase. Like in South Africa, there's demand and both at the organized retail market and also your Dragon City, Maravastat, Oriental Plaza. There are people who are, there's a demand of this type of clothing. And I don't think this problem is in South Africa, it's all over the world. As a result of the business model, the Chinese industry is very, what would I say, pushing their products. In order to control that, we need a stronger trade policy. And we need to say what type of trade agreements do we have with some of our trading partners. What safeguards are in those trade agreements? If you remember with the MOU with China, that has elapsed early this year. The quota system was placed on the MOU to try and limit the value, the volumes of goods coming into South Africa from China. But it didn't quite help. It didn't. So now what we need to do is relook through together with DTI, of course. That's their area. What other measures do you want to put in place which are not non-tariff barriers? So the trade area is a little bit, for us, complicated. But DTI would be the right entity to look into how we deal with that. On the other point that the doctor mentioned on treatment of Chinese nationals at the airport, we responded, and I think we're going to work together with the doctor to get to the bottom of those issues. The Ngonyama raised an issue around technical expertise, and we agree. I think it is unjustifiable to be coming here 15 years in the new order and say we don't have technical skills to do our work. Discussions have been initiated with Rand Afrikaanse University. I don't know what they're called now. University of Johannesburg. Also with University of Pretoria, to try and get our people and create a school there. What we managed to do was that the first part of the school has been created at the Tech Institute at the University of Pretoria, which we in a way sponsor. From a customs technical perspective, we could only get agreements with some of the universities outside South Africa that are already having established schools in customs. We've got a strategic alliance with the University of Canberra in the US, in Australia, sorry. So we've got programs up to masters in customs that are currently running. And you can only send a few, you can only send a smaller group to that university. They do distant learning via e-learning and all that. But our plan is to engage more of these training institutions. And if we can have a local university, that would be the best. We have tried it within SADC to have certain tertiary institutions within the SADC Union providing this type of training. One of the universities in Zimbabwe tried. They dropped the whole program because it was too costly. But it's one area that we'll continue to look at and improve it. We've got our own academy, the Customs Academy. The academy itself is in Megawatt Park. At the EFCOM offices, we're renting some space there. In a year, we train up to 500 customs officers on a number of courses. From the 2nd of November, we'll be training 220 new recruits So we've got a cadet program where people come in after either acquiring matric or a university qualification. They are taken through what customs is all about. They'll be earning a stipend. They'll also go for, if they want to go to the border security part of customs, they'll go for a paramilitary training for a period not less than 12 weeks. If they are interested in that area, they'll go there. So the other thing that we've got a graduate program. We identify final year students at university doing certain courses. For technical expertise on value, tariff, and origin, we're targeting young people who are doing BCom degrees. We recruit them from university. When they complete, they come and work with us. They go on that cadet program. If they find the area appealing to them, they decide to stay. Some of them, after that 12-month period, they say, hey, I'm leaving, I'm going somewhere. So, but we've got programs in place in trying and attract new people into the organization, but especially the graduates. What I would say is that if we had enough resources, we would even go and recruit more. By the way, Customs has got only 2,600 employees out of 14,000 that staff have got. From 14,000, we've got 2,600. So we're trying through this program to increase our numbers. With the increase in terms of trade, you need to have competent staff to deal with that increase in trade.
Is that your ideal number, according to your circumstances?
No. Look, what our ideal number was to move the current 2,600 to at least 5,000 by year 2011. In doing that, we'll be able to deal with some of the problems. And we also want to get our people to specialize in certain areas, like the technical areas. Currently, majority of our people are generalists. Majority of them work in the back office. They process entries. They push paper. With automation, we think that in customs, about 1,000 people will be able to be freed and be used in the frontline border control work. With our bringing in technology, about 1,000 people will be freed from what they are doing currently, because a lot of it will be automated and all that. On the our role in combating commercial import fraud, I think I agree with Honorable Ngonyama. Government needs to focus in this thing. Government as a whole, not only SARS. Maybe the place will be found somewhere where and that expertise could be ring-fenced. What I would say is that currently with the police's commercial crimes unit, or the Hawks, as they currently know, that expertise is not there. And that is why the Hawks' predecessors used a lot of these KPMG, Deloitte, and Touche accountants to conduct their investigations, especially technical investigations like those, where there's a lot of paper trail. They didn't do it themselves. They'll go out and use your top five accounting firms to build that case. So I think that expertise is not there in government from an investigative point of view and the actual work that needs to happen. There was a question that Honorable Mabasa raised on world trade and competition and all the issues related to trade. My colleague Eric Kick will respond to. On security measures taken by SARS in detecting goods in transit, my colleague who I should ask to move next to the mic, Patrick Matos, should respond to the issue around what are we doing in detecting illicit goods in transit, in containerized trucks and all that. Patrick?
Maybe they can all come to the table so that they're able to
Okay. Okay, Chair. And Mr. Matosi will respond to that. I've spoken about the learnership and graduate program. What I forgot to say, with our paramilitary unit, we have signed an MOU with the National Defense Force. They've got young men and women, they train, they send on peace missions abroad. When they come back after that 9 to 12 month program, they are virtually laid off. They're told to go home. When something comes up, they'll be recalled again. What we have done is that we're taking those young men and women into custody. They are going to our border control function. To date, we've got about 300 of them in our service. We still plan to attract them. So instead of them going into doing crime, we are taking them into the system. There was a question raised by Honorable Lyon on measures in place to curb the problem, and I think it also links to the role that we play in Nigeria. I think the our response to the problem as outlined will be on those slides that talk about SARS's response. If you remember, we were saying we're participating in these structures created by government because we feel you need a whole of government approach to dealing with the problem. The investigation of cases and audits was just part of that. So, but we believe our plan covers all areas that need to be covered. There's a strengthening ties with our partners now because we can't do this on our own. It's to tighten the policy area in DTI, ensuring that NEDLAC gets involved in this. And the reason why NEDLAC is involved, Chairperson, is all policy and legislative changes to the customs law in terms of the NEDLAC Act needs to be discussed at NEDLAC. So if we had a choice, I'm sure we'll try and push for this thing. And all the interested parties have to discuss whether we're coming up with a new customs legislation or an amendment to the Customs Act. It should go through NEDLAC, unfortunately. That's the arrangement at the moment. So we have spoken about the training of people already, as Honorable Sotesi has said, and we agree. I think it is not justifiable to still be saying today that we are battling with training in certain expertise. The question that you also asked, Honorable Sotesi, was whether we're winning the battle. I think in the beginning we're facing some challenges. But if what we have as our plan materializes, we'll say confidently that we're winning the war, not only the battle. And I'm saying that it is our conviction that in order for us to deal with this problem, you will need South African business to change the way they conduct business. To make that sector, the clothing, textile, footwear, and leather sector competitive. There are people in South Africa who believe that clothing apparel in this country is overpriced. And these are people who will justify going and buy imported clothing. But I think you need in the NEDLAC setup for us to really look into all those things. Why are people buying cheap imported clothing when they can't support our industry in Woodstock and other places? Is it because our clothes are highly priced, or is it because we just like imported goods? Because imported goods have got names and all that. But you need that fully integrated planning. There's an issue about changing of heart and mind. I mean, we as a country, we launched the Buy Local, or 100% proudly South African. But we are not really supportive of those things. We are not. You know, they've just become slogans that we from time to time recite. But that's where the heart of the matter is. So what customs does, what DTI does, what the police does, only supports that philosophy that we have developed as a country. You need a philosophy which says we need to support our local market. And in supporting our local market, this is what we contribute to. I mean, if 40,000 people have lost their jobs, it's not 40, it's 40 by 8. So it's 40 and 8 people that each of those women in those industries, in those sectors support. So the economic effect of this thing is huge. So I think that's the message we need to start sending as government, as civil society, and as business.
We are left with about 10 minutes.
Okay, we'll try and... I think I've spoken about what Honorable Julie raised on the relationship at the border. He asked a question on the low levels of compliance. I think the low levels of compliance is compliance with certain trade schemes that are there, that the GPI has introduced. Let's talk about the motor industry development program, which is now going to be replaced by a new one. That's what the chair asked when she said the MIDP, the Motor Industry Development Program, which was introduced by GTI to try and promote creation of jobs in the motor manufacturing sector in South Africa. So if BMW, Nissan, or Ford manufacture cars for export purposes to the foreign market, they've got certain tax rebates that they've got. So, for instance, you create jobs locally, you manufacture a lot of cars in order for you to export them to foreign markets. And by doing that, there are certain incentives that you get. So I think these are some of the things. Some of these companies from time to time will try and cut the corners, and that's the non-compliance I was referring to, or low levels of compliance, Honorable Ndulu. I think on the question of how can Parliament assist, I think one tangible issue would be that we've got new two bills that are coming through Parliament early next year. There's the Customs Control Act and the Customs Duty Act. I think in those two bills, we try to close all the gaps that are there in terms of fraudulent activity and all that. So it will be tabled before Parliament, I'm told, in the near future. I think it would be good for parliamentarians to really go through them and probe and critique us for what we're trying to do. I think it's only in that spirit of vibrant discussion, I think we'll be able to take this thing forward. And also look into where the country needs to go, trade facilitation or securing our borders. The two are not mutually exclusive, but there's a thin line between the two. So we need to sort of, when that debate starts, especially around the creation of a single border management agency, the single border management agency in the main will be around border security. But there's a facilitation of trade also, that if you don't facilitate trade properly, the economy may not grow at the pace that you want it to grow. I think we will need wisdom of Parliament in making some of those calls, Chair. Sure. I'll hand over to my colleagues to sort of add where they think they need to add.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just briefly to pick up on a few issues. But I want to emphasize the point, the last point made by Mr. Ravelli. We need to be very clear and look at this thing in a comprehensive end-to-end way. Most of the trade that crosses our borders are legitimate. You have to bear that in mind. Are legitimate. By far, the biggest percentage would be legitimate. You know, people are doing business and they want to do it in a very honest way. But that trade doesn't take place in a vacuum. We've got a regulatory framework that's been established in South Africa, a policy and legal framework within which that trade takes place. And we have to realize that sometimes there are competing interests in that policy and regulatory framework. For example, the opening up of the markets. In 1994, when the Uruguay round of the World Trade Organization was finalized, South Africa made very significant, deep commitments to the World Trade Organization with respect to our bound tariffs. And the member also asked a question about automobiles in the WTO. Obviously, if you remove your tariffs, you're opening up your market. And some countries out there, and we've mentioned some of the names, are highly competitive. So obviously it is going to have an impact on employment in uncompetitive sectors in the South African economy. Now, if you look at clothing and textiles, we've just focused on one little part today, and that's the customs fraud bit. But keep in mind, there's a lot that comes in because of the policy and the legal framework that we have in South Africa, completely legitimately. So if you look at the job losses, you can't equate the job losses, the number that was mentioned, 50,000 with customs fraud. That's not the case. Most of that would be due because of legitimate trade, because we are dealing with highly competitive trading partners in areas where we've built up jobs in South Africa because of very high tariff barriers. Now, if we start chipping away at those tariff barriers, then you are going to lose jobs. It's as simple as that. But you also have to realize it's not a question of just keeping the barriers high. Because these things are reciprocal, to get market access for areas where we are competitive, like, for example, platinum exports, gold exports, etc., you have to enter into a reciprocal arrangement. So someone will say, I'll give you better access for the things that you produce, gold, platinum, diamonds, etc., but I'm a big producer of clothing, of textiles, of autos, or whatever, so what are you giving me back in return? So this is the dynamism of the international trade environment from a regulatory perspective. Chairperson, there was a question with respect to bilateral investment treaties, the BITs. We follow the review, but it does not really have a direct impact on this issue on discussion here. Then also the issue of developed countries and the emerging economies. You would have read in the newspapers recently, China may be an emerging economy, but they are the number one trader in the world from this year. For the past 40 years, it was Germany because of high value-added machinery, autos, precision instruments that they manufactured. But this year, the biggest trader in the world by value is China. So that's a very interesting phenomenon. I can perhaps just conclude by saying a lot of the issues that we're talking about here are not unique to South Africa. They're experienced by many other countries in the world. But from a customs perspective, what we are very, very happy about is the recognition of the customs administrative issues when it comes to these type of debates. For very long, they've been ignored. And we are one of the top 30 trading nations in the world. We're the biggest trader in Africa, and we have to understand that it doesn't stop with making policies and laws. It's got a lot to do with the money that we've got to put into the administrative efforts that are required to make sure that our trade is above board. Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Patrick Matos. I'll be very short in response to the question on the issue of whether we can interdict on the containers that are seen being ferried across the road. Yes, indeed we can, and we are guided in that instance by the procedures of the guidelines that we have and we acceded to through the revised Kyoto Convention that deals with the issues around where we can intervene, how we can intervene, and follow the proper procedures with regard to fairness. But all in all, again, we cannot intervene on each and every one of those on the basis of maybe the capacity that we have of meaning such interdictions. For those that happen at the ports of entry, we do have the risk management tools that we utilize in terms of targeting such, but not all of them are going to be stopped. So on the basis of risk, we will stop some of them and then examine them to check as to whether the goods that are carried inside are those that have been declared and so on. But in short, yes, we can intervene, but it will depend on the information or the intelligence that we can receive either from our colleagues in other government departments that deal with intelligence or even from the civil society. That's very short what I can say.
Thank you, Chair. Mkwadi Sibasi, I was asked just to respond on the question that was raised in relation to the discrepancy between the quantities and the value of the seized goods. I think what we need to sort of understand on that particular step is that the value of goods that was provided is based on the nature of the goods. So what we then need to sort of realize is that some of the goods are not of similar value. So you could have high quantity, low value, or low value, high quantity. That is why then the stats would not correlate, that when you have 100,000 quantities, therefore then it must be a particular million, because it's based on the brand or the type of a goods or other similar characteristics. So that was the only reason that there would be discrepancies. Thank you.
Any foul play by officials in that regard?
Similar response. We have got, as part of the steps that we'll give you even cases of theft from our warehouses. And business also, I think, contributes to this. In many cases, people, we will seize these goods from traders. They are the ones who go and organize armed people to come and rob us and take the goods again into circulation. The biggest commodity that they steal from our warehouse is cigarettes. That they are counterfeit or they were illegally imported. People will come to our warehouses armed in AK-47. They'll tie security, they'll go in there and break it. And even counterfeit clothing, it happens. That's what is happening. We're trying to jack up our security. Chair, you raised the question that I feel we should answer is on the number of cases and number of examinations. I think cases, that's what is called in customs language, but they're not like, is number of transactions identified by the risk engine a year. So the risk engine will say, these are the cases that you need to look at. And then in looking at those cases, you'll sample a few and conduct an examination. An examination is opening a container, either tailboarding or unpacking and putting things on the ground. And then out of that, then you'll determine which one should go for audit. It may not be the whole 259. Out of the 259, you select a few for audit, and so on and so forth.
No, thank you very much. I think that was quite explicit. And although I think on the issue of planning, I'm not quite happy around that, because you can still plan. Even if a treaty is agreed upon, it's their responsibility to then advise. Say, okay, out of what has been agreed upon, these are the risk areas. This is what we feel we can be able to do in mitigating those risks. I think that's what I feel we really still, we can hide behind anything, but if our planning is not correct, we are not going to win. Colleagues, I think let's leave it at that, with an understanding that we are still awaiting information in terms of the your question, Ma'am Sotesi. Was it Ma'am Sotesi? Yes. It was related to statistics, yes. I think that is very clear. We are awaiting that information. There's also information. No? Yes. I think we'll be, yeah, in terms of the time frames, yes. What we'll do, the secretary will then put everything in writing just to remind you on issues that you need to respond to us. Without wasting more time, we need to release you so that we can use the 15 minutes or 10 minutes to... Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
And thank you for the information. It's very valuable. Please remain for the next 5 minutes at least. We must indicate that we are going to approve a program right now. If approved, then it means we are going to come back to you in terms of the visit to some of the ports of entry. Please.
think our last item relates to the consideration of the program for the remainder of the there's a program before you, a draft program that we want to take to the Chair of Chairs for approval. I think it's quite straightforward if you look at it. This is mainly to visit this areas to enhance our work. Mainly in trying to respond to the framework agreement and to check whether what they've been telling us is actually taking place, and perhaps to see whether we can't reveal certain things through this visit that might assist, you know, the framework to be speeded up. This is all what we are requesting the committee to consider. If it's agreed upon, then we will be sending it for approval by the chair of chairs responsible for committees. You'll indicate by show of hands if you want to support it or if you want to anything to be amended. Mr. Ngonyama?
Madam Chair, I support.
Thank you. Dr. Rabi?
I'd like to agree with colleague next to me, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Ma'am Sotis, you wanted to say something contrary?
Not contrary, Chair. Just to get clarity on the approach for oversight. Are we going there unannounced or going to two people that are coming?
We dealt with that, Ms. When you were not around, I guess. So I will brief you outside the meeting. But otherwise, there is general agreement in the program. Thank you very much, colleagues. That then concludes the meeting for today, and thank you for your participation and attendance. Thank you.
Yes.
Lunch is served down.
Lunch will be provided here in the cafeteria.
In the cafeteria, okay. Thank you.
Thank you.